Welcome to the Mad Men Happy Hour, the officially unofficial podcast for Mad Men on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back for what I think is our final podcast in this run of coverage for Mad Men. It's the Season 7 wrap-up.
Is that our final podcast?
No. In this little chunk. You know, we've got some plans that we're going to talk about here in a little bit, but what are we going to be covering in this podcast?
Well, first of all, I want to get a little personal, a little sappy.
Oh boy!
You know, I want to thank everybody that's listening to this. That's stayed tuned after all the main coverage is over. And Mad Men is one of our very first shows we covered on the fledgling Bald Move Empire, and it means a great deal to me. It easily could have been our first. You know, if you've listened to our backstory, you know that we kind of wanted to do Mad Men. And then we screwed up the timing, and then we kind of wanted to do season one of Walking Dead. We screwed up the timing. We finally came through on season four of Breaking Bad, and the rest is history. But, you know, Mad Men was one of the first golden age of television shows that I'd seen, and it's the one that I probably connect. Like, we're going to talk about how this relates into the Pantheon and whether it's our favorite series of all time later. Spoiler alert, it's mine. but we'll talk about that more later. But the podcast itself has also been one of the most consistently intellectually stimulating and also funniest podcasts we've done. And that's kind of remarkable that we could go from these like really airy discussions of philosophy about literature and cultural significance. And then we go like almost slapstick humor with the Pete Pit and all that stuff in a single space of a single podcast, because that's what Mad Men could do as well.
Yep.
You know, it could have Lane Price punching out Pete and a few episodes later swinging from his door, and you got the highest of highs and lowest of lows, and nothing felt, you know, I remember some of my favorite episodes of the X-Files are like the silly ones, like the pizza delivering vampires. but those always felt like it's something that's outside the X-Files main canon, you know, the ghost story episode. Whereas Mad Men could do this and it just all still felt like Mad Men, and that's really special. And it's something that I don't, you know, Breaking Bad mixed humor and drama very well as well. But again, the way it could go all over the map and still kind of feel of a whole, I thought was interesting, and it's really liberating to podcast a show like that. And we've had so many really smart and funny people too. I mean, I think about all the people have written to us over the years, the advertisers, children of the 50s and 60s, had an escort, gay men and women, comedians, professional artists, housewives, husbands, fathers, mothers, even people to work for McCann Erickson right now. It's just been a really amazing experience. And, you know, we famously take out all of like the quote unquote dick sucking, the like, hey, love your podcast, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I want to comment, you know, take this time to say, even though we cut it out just because, first of all, we don't have a lot of time. We have so much email to read already. And also it's just really awkward, and I'm kind of self-conscious to read people like congratulating us all the time. Mm-hmm. But I do want to say that I really appreciate the constant stream of positivity and respect for what we've done here in the podcast. This season, we were like either number one or number two on iTunes TV and films ranking. And if we were number two, it's because our Game of Thrones podcast was number one that week. And that's all due to the listeners. It's you. You guys have got us to this point. And
yeah, we can't do that.
No, we tried on another podcast. It didn't work so well. You need listeners. You need people to support us. And I, again, thank you so much for all of the kind words we've gotten this week. I was surprised. Usually, sometimes these wrap-up casts can be a little daunting to come up with content. Mm-hmm. 30, 40 pages of feedback. And again, I can only read 12 or so of those.
Okay.
So, and the ones that killed me the most are people that sent in like really in-depth treaties about what Peggy meant to them or Don meant to them. And I always try to find a couple paragraphs as like the core, but these are just so well researched and so well reasoned, so well articulated that like I couldn't just take apart and talk about it, and I couldn't say, well, it's what do you think about the concept of Peggy, you know, that would have any of their words. And
yeah.
But I read it all, and it was all super interesting. I'm going to try to get back to a lot of those people that didn't make it. I've already gotten back to some that didn't make the first cut, but I still really appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned all the different types of people who wrote into us, you know, on a show that encouraged a lot of different, a lot of thought on a lot of different subjects. And that's the thing, I guess, that I take away from Mad Men and my time podcasting Mad Men that I don't get on other shows usually. Yeah. You know, it used the time and it used the era to contrast with what we feel is normal today and how we've progressed since then.
Sure.
And really make you think about those issues. Think of minorities and think of, you know, how people are treated and families and what that means and happiness and what that means. And like all of these questions that this show brought up were bigger than a lot of questions that television tends to deal with.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's one of the things that made it really, really a standout in this golden age of television.
Yeah. And, you know, for two guys in their 30s in the Midwest, it's impossible for us to have the total perspective to appreciate this show. And that's where you guys have come in with your emails every week and your comments on our Facebooks and our forums and all that stuff. You've really helped us round out the coverage.
Yeah. So many of even just the references, you know, even those small things.
Sure.
But you know, it's interesting that you mentioned we're a couple of dudes in our 30s. I feel like this show wouldn't resonate with me if I was in my 20s, if I was 25 watching this show. Even though, you know, I miss a lot of the stuff that is specific to the 60s and the 70s. But I think people in a certain time of life start to ask themselves these same questions mm-hmm. that a lot of these characters are asking themselves. Mm-hmm. And that makes it even more interesting for me.
Yeah. No, and that's Mad Men's been interesting because I've gone on this really weird journey. Like when I first started watching the show, I just gotten divorced. I just, you know, left this really high control cult group. And now I'm a podcaster of television shows.
Uh-huh.
That's a real Dick Whitman to Don Draper. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not very far you can extend the analogy with me personally, but I've been on a life's journey at the same time I had Mad Men watching. And I think that's also, you know, kind of lightning in a bottle for me in the golden age of television. I've had that same experience where my life experience at the time of watching it can't be separated from Mad Men and Breaking Bad and The Wire, for example, and how much those mean to me. So something that we got yesterday on Memorial Day that I was completely blown away by, Tom Wilson, who has edited 25 episodes of Mad Men, he reached out to us and he said a bunch of stunning things. One, that he was a fan of our podcast and had been listening for several years. I was just like, okay, I mean, we've always joked about what if the wiener heard this or what if some, you know, but mm-hmm. the fact that someone that actually, you know, matters in the scheme of the production of Mad Men was listening to our podcast completely blew me away.
Astounding. Sure.
Yeah. Like I texted you and I'm like, stop what you're doing right the fuck now and look at look at this email that just came in. Two, he has spoken personally with Matthew Weiner and has shared some of the fan theories and observations from this podcast with him. And apparently Matt got a kick out of it. Now,
right.
I know the burning question in your mind is, did he tell him about the wiener stuff? And no, he wisely decided not to share our little personal nickname with him. But, you know, the wieners, it was always something out of respect. Like before we were doing the podcast, every single time it would fade to black and go created, produced or whatever by Matthew Weiner. Mm-hmm. We would sit there in my living room and be like, ah, that wiener.
He's done it to us again.
Yep. He's done it to us again. And it's a sign of respect that, I don't know. I can't argue that calling him the wiener is a sign of respect, but it is.
No.
It is.
Yeah. It's a little bit of an in-joke, but it's also, you know, he became a figure greater than a man to us, you know, kind of like the Villigan.
Yes.
You get a reputation where you consistently deliver over and over again, and you become the wiener.
It is. And he's, you know, stood on the the shoulders of giants, working on Sopranos, and the fact that he's able to take that ball and move it a little bit further down the line in this golden age is just remarkable. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Tom graciously offered himself up as an interview subject, which, you know, we don't do a lot of celebrity type interviews, but we love talking about the kind of below the line guys, about the meat and potatoes of how this show is produced. And we accepted instantly. I don't know. He's a busy guy. I don't know if it's going to be this week. I don't know if it's going to be next week. But we're going to have a podcast out soon with an interview with him as soon as we get our schedule together. Now, if you'd like to think of questions that you'd like to ask him through us, send those in to madmen@baldmove.com. I'm going to post an IMDb link to his resume so you can get an idea of what episodes he was on. But just to get the ball rolling, I know he edited the finale, Person to Person, as well from this half season, Severance and Time and Life. Other standouts as I was looking through his resume that jumped out to me were A Day's Work, Crash, that's the one where everybody in the office gets high, The Other Woman, Lady Lazarus, The Suitcase, Guy Walks Into the Advertising Agency, that's the one where a guy's foot gets ran over by the lawnmower. I can't wait to see what it's like to be an editor on this show and what you actually start off with, how much Matt was involved in the process. And, you know, getting that, these assembles of scenes and getting those onto the screen for us. I'm really curious. We've never actually talked to an editor before.
No, we haven't.
It's going to be exciting. Also, I want to talk about our expanded coverage of Mad Men seasons 1-7, something we kind of hinted at last week. I'm going to start rewatching season 1 in June, and I'm going to commit to having a podcast for season 1 in its entirety out at the end of that month. Then we'll do season 2 in July, season 3 in August, so on and so forth. I'm going to also, like a week or two before we record the podcast, send out a blast on Facebook and on the forums and on Twitter, you know, letting you guys know if you want to send in some comments and commentary. If we get some, great. If not, we'll just do our own personal thoughts. The one thing I want to do is, like, this has been bugging me, is to come up with, like, my definitive, which is my season is my favorite, which episode is my favorite. Mm-hmm. And the way I want to approach that is, like, I'm going to get done watching season 1. Season 1 is my favorite episode of Mad Men. Then we go to season 2 and we argue about, is it better or worse? Same thing. Pick an individual episode that's the best episode for a given season and then put that gladiatorial style, you know, NCAA bracket style, head to head. And then by the time we're done with all 7 seasons, we'll have the answer to those.
Okay. Are we going to talk at all in this podcast about what we think currently?
That's the next thing I'm going to get to. But the other thing I want to do is also look at standout moments that seem, you know, we've already talked about a ton of them because, you know, AMC helped us out by having this marathon. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of, I'm sure there'll be some standout scenes that will, now that we've seen the whole picture, will be, you know, more relevant or more interesting. And I really want to pluck those out and say, you know, what are the bones of Mad Men? You know, what is everything hanging on? So I'm looking forward to that.
Okay.
So, again, be watching Facebook and baldmove.com and Twitter, and the feed, keep the feed active because we'll be dropping these once a month. And we still got the interview with Mr. Wilson as well. One thing I talked about last week was I wanted to go through each character and judge them. Okay. Or not okay.
Do, so you're talking about the end of the series. Are they going to be all right?
Yes. Do they get Roger to cradle their face and their hands and say, you're okay?
Gotcha.
Don Draper. Okay, not okay.
Not okay.
Why do you think he's not okay?
I kind of spelled it out last episode in my somewhat pessimistic take on the finale. I think he goes back to McCann. He repeats the cycle. He comes up with he synthesizes his experience at the cliffside retreat there into the Coke commercial and does what he does at McCann.
All right. I agree with you. I just want to spin off. And like I said in the previous episode, I think the key is he learned to love himself. Okay. Also, I think previous season Dons would have not listened to Sally, would not have listened to Betty, and would have done what they think they needed to do in that moment, come back and cause a bunch of chaos in their life.
Yeah.
The fact you can't run away from a situation where people are saying stay away from. So this felt ultimately different because he was allowing, even though this is offended to his ego, and his personal image of what a father should do, he recognized the truth of the words and respected that. And I think that's also a sign of true growth and progress. And also, again, in my headcanon, he goes back, you know, he spends the next year or two being a better father in the week, you know, getting him for the weekends, not blowing him off for the holidays. And he's going to work out an arrangement between him and Henry and Sally that he'll be more involved in the boys' lives.
Okay. Everything you're saying is adding up to, he is okay.
He is okay.
Okay. I don't know how you agree with me then. I said not okay.
No, I agree with every one of your interpretations of fact. He is going to go back to McCann Erickson. He is going to write the ultimate coke ad.
Okay.
He's
going to
do, he's
you,
just going
you
to
put the optimistic
stop
layer.
Doing all the bullshit.
All right.
Peggy Olson. Okay. Not okay.
Peggy Olson. Okay.
I don't know if her and Stan are true blue forever and ever, but yes, she is going to be fantastically successful by her own definition. And yeah. I think that's, we got that. Like, you know, when she laid out her, what she wants to accomplish in life and Don was shitting on him, she's like, you know, fuck you. This is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I think she can accomplish that.
I mean, we have seen her being unhappy in her home life. And I think Stan could be the final piece to Peggy's puzzle of happiness.
Yep.
So I think okay.
Pete Campbell. Okay, not okay.
Man. God damn it. He's okay. He's okay. I hate it, but he's okay.
That's right? The biggest shock.
I feel like the last couple of episodes, they turned him so 180 that he might actually be okay.
The last few episodes serve as a plausible moment of clarity.
Yes.
Like, you, every person you meet that's been clean and sober for 20 years was a raging alcoholic or in the throes of drug addiction at one point in their life, doing crazy things to get to the next day. And you'd never, at that moment, you'd never say, oh, yeah, this guy's going to get himself cleaned up and be, you know, a model businessman, a husband, a father. But they sometimes do.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Pete had a moment of clarity where all those things where Don was saying about, you know, appreciating what you have and you don't make the same mistakes I did. And seeing this man that's, you know, 10 plus years his senior make these mistakes, I think he finally realized what he needs to be happy.
Yeah. And he had a run there where he was, like you said, emulating Don. And it was not working out for him at all.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's not as smooth as Don. He's not as attractive as Don. He's...
And how much trouble can you get into in, what is it, Wichita?
Yeah.
How much trouble can you get into Wichita?
Not that much, right?
There's not that many prostitutes willing to crown you king out there, I don't think.
Probably not.
Probably wrong. I'm sure there's plenty of prostitutes.
They're all
going to
write in next week. wait, next week. We don't have a show next week.
Maybe.
I think he's okay.
The Crash Tom's interview.
There you go.
All the whores of Wichita, they must be heard. Betty Francis.
Well, not okay. I mean, long term, yeah, not okay. Short term, like,
yeah,
kind of okay, you know?
Yeah.
In the few days that she has left.
You know what? We've been watching True Detective because we're gearing up. And by the way, if you want a reason to stay with us, our summer schedule includes True Detective and Fear the Walking Dead. There's big contrast in styles and themes there. But we've been watching a lot of season one to get our season one coverage prepped. And Russ said something in, I think it's episode three, it's episode two. He's like, after these many years, I know who I am. And there's a victory in that. And I feel like that applies to Betty too.
Sure.
You know, it's too bad that it's literally at the end of the tunnel for her.
Mm-hmm.
But she knows what she is, and she knows who she is and where she stands in the world and what she wants out of it, and she'll be okay for 6 months and then she'll die.
You know, we didn't really discuss this during the last podcast, but do you think that Betty's sudden diagnosis has that similar effect on Don, that Don realizes, hey, there's an end to all this and I need to figure this stuff out?
I think so, because that's, you know, it also ties in with his kind of gut punch with the Rachel deal. I mean, all these women that he's been involved with dying of cancer before their time, you know? Yeah. I do think that that's one of the reasons that I can say that with fair confidence that I think Don will be okay. That,
right.
You know, he has seen the light.
Okay.
The best things in life are free.
Who else you got? You're going to ask me about Harry at some point.
Plus, Betty will die, and then he'll, you know, like, he'll have the ghost of Betty Draper slash Francis to set him straight. You know, he's now got the ghosts of his brother, a tap dancing Bert, and Betty speaking Italian.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong with that kind of co-piloting. Sally Draper.
Man. I honestly felt like she was always going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, her parents were trying their damnedest to fuck her up.
But she's tough.
But she's too strong for that. Yeah. I felt like she was too resilient, too strong, too, I don't know, too mature for all that stuff.
My only worry for her is that it's great of her to be the mother for Bobby and Jean, but that is also a weight that a girl her age shouldn't have to bear.
I agree. Yeah.
And I'm worried that that is going to rob her of some of her youth that she could probably use to, you know, go off and do other things. I hope she doesn't do something crazy like not go to college so she can be with them, or, you know, I hope she goes and lives her life.
Didn't go to Spain, right?
Yeah. Because I think, you know, I don't think he's on our list of okay. Yeah, he is actually. Henry Francis. I am a little worried about him and, you know, the boys saying that he's really withdrawn and thrown himself into work, you know, after he's lost this fight. But we've always assumed that he'd be good because he's been almost saint-like in his patience with Betty and the kids so far. But
yeah,
I'm a little worried about that.
So
I want her to be okay, but I'm not as sure.
I think she's okay.
If Don pulls his shit together, then yes, I think she's okay. If Don goes on another bender and keeps on going like he does, and she's left to be the mother of these children without his support at all, I don't know. Not okay. So if I believe like you believe, she's not okay. If I believe like I believe, she's okay. So,
all right.
Not a great argument to believe how you believe there, Jim. Joan Harris. Okay. Not okay.
Joan Harris. Okay. You know, I mean, she wants something more out of life, but I don't know that that's going to get to her.
And she's willing to make sacrifices to get it.
Yeah, and I don't know.
I thought the Richard thing was a big test for her.
It was, and she clearly made a choice there. Yep. She got what she wanted.
She could have pulled out the accordion and played a song, made everybody happy, but she stuck to her guns. This is what I want to do.
Forgot about that, man. It's a deep cut.
It is.
I think she's okay.
Roger Sterling.
Yeah, he's probably going to die soon, but he's okay.
So, is a relationship as combustible as his and Marie's sustainable in the long term? Like, I get it, it's cute, and the newness of the experience of a woman that's like that strong and powerful and that can like stand on the stage with him is novel and fun and very entertaining to him. But 5 years of that, because Roger's not going to change. Marie's not going to change.
No.
They're not the type to just let each other be. I don't know.
I see a lot of him storming out
of bedrooms with comforters draped around his waist in his future.
Okay, sure. Whenever she gets a little insecure about what she's going to do when Roger leaves her, Roger's going to the couch.
Or when, I don't know. I'm kind of leaning not okay with him.
Yeah,
He's made no sign. I mean, other than wanting to provide for his son.
What does being okay look like with Roger?
Good question.
Roger's kind of okay with whatever happens to him, isn't he?
That's true. The only thing that's really thrown him is the death of his mother.
Yeah.
And the fact that Joan kind of played hardball, like he just assumed he'd be a part of his son's life. She's like, no, you're an unstable, unreliable asshole.
That's true, yeah.
So he's kind of okay from that perspective, because he does seem like he is finally willing to do whatever he can for this little boy on Joan's terms. Like, he's like kind of like what I hope Don comes back. Like, I get it. I've been terrible.
Yeah.
But I want to do what I can, and you tell me what that is. And that's something that he can build some trust, and maybe he can be a part of the kid's life going forward. Still, I'm leaning not okay. It's a lot of drugs, a lot of strain on a man's heart.
Well, I mean, eventually everyone is not okay, right?
Well, I mean, no, you can die happy. You can die old and happy. That's okay.
but you're gonna die. Like that's my thing. Like Roger doesn't seem to get fazed by it too much.
All right.
So I can't imagine he won't be happy, you know, won't be okay until the day he dies.
Ken Cosgrove. Okay, not okay.
Ken. He's not doing what he loves. That's a problem.
I think he fails the Joan Harris test. He was given the opportunity to do what he loved, yeah, or to act out of some petty, spiteful impulse. And look at the type of guy he is in the last scenes we've seen him are not do not seem like a happy guy. He seems like he's rushed. He's like ultra competitive and this and that. I mean, maybe he really enjoys and thrives on that. But I got to think that a man with two eyes writing novels would have been happier than the guy who got his eye blown out by the car execs, and now he's not going to write.
I think you're right. I think not okay for Ken.
Which is a bummer, because he seems like a good dude.
Well, he turned into a good dude, yeah.
But he turned his back on it.
Sure.
Harry Crane.
Not okay. There's no world in which Harry Crane is okay.
His arteries are clogging in that as he was plowing into the cookies.
Oh, they are.
He doesn't make it down the elevator.
Well, no, the elevator goes out. He doesn't make it down the stairs.
Not okay. Stan Rizzo. Yeah. Okay, not okay.
Stan's okay. Stan's always okay, man.
Stan is okay. He's good in every hood. He's cool in every room.
Just give him a joint and he is okay.
He's going to be fine. Like, yep. Peggy could break his heart. He'll eventually be okay.
Yep.
I can define him by his okayness. Megan, formerly Draper. I don't know if she goes back to Calvé or what.
Oh, man. I'm going to say not okay. I mean, she's got $1 million, but her acting career is kind of fizzled.
Yeah.
Because she went a little crazy.
And then this career is brutal to women, man. Like, I was just watching, I've been watching a lot of Amy Schumer of late, and they had this funny skit where Julie Louise Dreyfus was celebrating her last fuckable day. If you're not discovered to have a breakout in, you know, like there's only so many Carrie Coons in the world where it's like you're kind of come out of nowhere in your 30s and take over the world.
Mm, yeah.
And Megan's back in the 70s, where that's even less true. Mm-hmm. I feel like she fucked up. Now, Don had a big hand in that, but like she missed her boat and she's still being kind of billed as this starlet. Like
I'm not placing blame necessarily on her. I'm just saying she's not going to really be okay.
Yeah.
Going forward.
I mean, she does have $1 million to her name.
Yeah, but I mean, if she really wants to act and that's the thing that's going to make her happy, then I don't know that's going to happen for her.
What do you think Roger made it seem like Megan was really okay with her and Roger hooking up.
Yeah.
If she is that okay and like kind of measured about it, then maybe she is okay.
Hmm.
And again, she's got $1 million, so it's not like she has to act, or maybe she can be a painter, or she can start a ballet studio, or she can be the high strung artiste that she's wanted to be. I don't know.
Maybe she'll hook up with Joan and get a movie made from her production company.
Ooh. She could be the spokesman for Harris Holloway.
Funded herself.
There you go.
Why not?
We're going to talk about Henry Francis. Final one, Michael Ginsburg.
No, not okay.
You don't think there's some lithium in his future? There's some Lexapro? There's like the right amount of chemicals that you get back? Because the man's a genius. And he's a good, he seems like a good guy when he's not talking crazy.
Cutting his nipples
monolith
off.
Stuff. Yeah.
No, I don't think he's okay.
Okay.
I think you pump a bunch of lithium into his system and he just gets worse.
All right. Dark. I kind of suspect. I mean, he's one nipple down. How okay can he be?
Yeah.
Rest of life. No nipples. Let's talk favorite season. This is a tough one because, you know, it's something that you said to me when we were recording the last podcast where I said, man, I don't know if it's dumb luck or what, but I've been dropping in and out of this Mad Men marathon as I've had time, and I've been working on other things. I turn on the background. Every single episode has been like an all-time great, and you're like, well, the luck would be if you spun the roulette wheel and you ended up with a shitty episode of Mad Men.
Yeah, yeah, because there are so few of them.
That is pretty impressive. I mean, I can't think of any bad episodes of Mad Men.
I can't either. Not a single one.
Like Breaking Bad, you know what I want to say. Episode 213 ABQ is a really bad episode for me and made me really angry and still kind of mad to this day. Season 5, The Wire, lots of stuff not to like in that. Mad Men, there's a couple episodes where I'm like, I'm not sure where he's building to this, but if it doesn't go anywhere, I'm going to be upset. And then it always went somewhere. There, maybe season 2. I remember Don wading off into the ocean, and I watched that, and I just thought, what the fuck? What the fuck? But I don't know if I, you know, that was me 6 years ago. Going back, there's none of those episodes that I had a problem with. They were just kind of weird, and I wasn't sure what they were trying to tell me. And maybe, I don't know, all the Bobby Barrett stuff is really interesting and really good. So maybe even that one. I mean, that's, if I think of seasons, that's certainly always going to be at the bottom of my list, but I don't know.
I recall there being an episode very recently that we didn't like. I think it was the one that starts out with the fur coat and Don's looking at the woman and we were just like, what the hell's going on here?
Sure.
At the end of it. I wouldn't give it to season 7 anyway.
Yeah,
I
mean, no.
Even if it was, didn't have that misstep in it.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think my favorite is probably season 5. That still had Lane Price around. You know, that was the culminated in the death of Lane Price and the Phantom. And we had Jaguar in the mix. And Pete Campbell was still Grimy Pete. He was more Grimy Pete than ever.
Oh, yeah.
There was a fist fight between Lane and Pete. I mean, I liked Lane as a character a lot.
Sure.
And I would say that season 5 is probably my favorite, specifically because I can't really remember much of the series before that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think we started covering it in season 4. Is that
right?
Not
even 5.
Maybe it was 5. But everything before that, I marathoned to get through. And it's been 4 or 5 years since I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I always go to season 3 because I think it felt like a bounce back year. Like I was kind of like confused about what season 2 is all about and how it ended and what this means for Don. And it started, it's like, you know, you shift from like Don being just awesome dude and like, oh my God. I mean, I remember that there's a Saturday Night Live skit about how like everybody wanted to be Don Draper. And then season 2, you started to question like, man, maybe Don is not got the world by the scruff and he's not just leading it wherever he wants to go. But season 3 felt like a big bounce back with culminating him stealing the firm from the Brits. And that, you know, I call it a heist. That whole heist arc was so, as you see it unfolding and you realize what's going on. And there was a lot of like crowning moments of awesome about Don's contract and Lane Price having to fire these guys. It's just really great and a very satisfying, almost Ocean's 11, very old school, cool way.
Yeah. See, that's the way I feel about, the Chrysanthemum and the Sword.
Right.
That particular episode where he steals the Honda contract from Teddy and his firm. I felt like it was very like Ocean's 11 type stuff. Cause I really don't remember season 3 at all.
You do. So the other thing is I feel like there's a very before Megan Draper, after Megan Draper divide for Mad Men. And my gut tells me that I'm going to prefer the stuff that came before Megan Draper to after. And in fact, like I really liked this last season, and this last finale was way more optimistic and hopeful than I ever thought we'd get. And I understand some people think it's crushing cynicism and despair.
Oh yeah.
But still, I kind of think, I wonder what Mad Men would be like if it ended at season 6.
Season six ended with him taking his kids to the Hershey speech, with the Hershey pitch,
and then culminating in him taking him back to Hershey and showing him where his childhood whorehouse.
Yeah.
And the look that he shared between Sally and himself, Don. So great. So great.
Yeah. And you could almost believe in a little bit of growth there, too.
And you could write any kind of finale. You could write any kind of future for those characters that you wanted to. Whereas everything, even though it is kind of ambiguous, we talked about it, you could read it a lot of different ways. There's a lot of people's futures. We absolutely know short term what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think so.
So, I you know, again, season 7 on balance, I think is really, really good. And I'm glad we got it.
Yeah.
But the final moment of season 6 is just so great. Such a great moment.
I agree.
So I don't know. Well, I think I'm going to have to wait to give the definitive nod and all that to after we get done with our seven season coverage.
Yeah, I got it.
That we'll finish up in early 2016, I think.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah.
I have to go back and watch the original few seasons.
All right, let's see what the fans have to say. Mitchin said, my first thoughts on the ending were pretty mixed. I did enjoy how the wiener wrapped up all the characters, but I really wanted to see just a glimpse of Don with his kids. Maybe just a cut. Just a taste. Or possibly getting rid of the last shot of Sally washing the dishes. That just seemed too bleak for me. I've agreed with Aaron that his relationship with the children is his most important connection. I just thought it merited a more obvious clue that he did in some way step up and be the father that his kids, and more specifically his sons, needed. Like, I kind of spoiled my thoughts on this, but I feel like that he did. By agreeing to Sally and Betty's plan, that was the kind of stepping up that he could plausibly do.
Yeah, he had to step out of the picture in order to step
up. Like, if Don had left everything and left the Bonneville Flats and come right home and, like, come here, kids, and hug them, would you really feel confident that this is going to be something that the kids needed long term? Or is he going to take them out of a stable situation and then introduce his own boozing and debauch? I mean, it's to me, that's that's almost more cynical than him being like, okay, I'm going to take the long. I have fucked up. Mm-hmm. I need to own my sins. I need to pay penance.
Yeah. I mean, it hasn't worked out the times that Sally has been around him, staying at his apartment and such. Mm-hmm. She's seen some pretty horrible things. I don't know that it would be any happier in the future.
This is a pretty uplifting one. Doug L. said, a lot of emailers wrote in feeling bummed that Don would essentially turn his personal growth inward towards itself to co-opt the touchy-feely messaging and sink back into an advertising downward spiral. There is evidence, however, to suggest the end is not so bleak. One clue is in the history of the song itself, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing, was indeed developed to sell Coke. But after the jingle became popular, it was re-recorded as a full-length song, and all the lyrics, references to Coke, were dropped. This version goes, I'd like to build a world a home and furnish it with love, grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. I'd like to hold it in my arms and keep it company. I'd like to see the world for once, all standing hand in hand, and hear them echo through the hills for peace throughout the land. I find that the lyrics about holding in my arms and keeping it company of particular significance to Don. As such, even if you believe that Don is using something good and perverting it, history says the song was eventually wiped clean of the corporate stain and re-released into the world as something pure. After all, he ends the episode greeting a literal new dawn. And just because something is mass-produced and corporate does not make it necessarily evil, after all, a Hershey bar can still be both a commodity and the only beacon of light in a dejected boy's sad, solitary world. Does that change your mind at all? The fact that the song was later decorporified into a message of optimism and hope. Is that something we can read into? I mean, clearly,
I'm not going to say you can't read into it.
Matthew Weiner has spent a lot of time thinking about this end.
Oh, yeah.
And he's got to know all this stuff too, right?
Yeah, you bet. I bet somebody else knows. His name's Tom Wilson. We can find out.
We'll see.
See what they're willing to reveal. I think
Matthew Weiner had this big curtain, and there was like flames and green smoke, and you could, you know, it's the great and all powerful Oz.
Yeah, I wonder if there's some kind of. I'm probably going to ask Tom this, but I think I don't know that a lot of people who create these kinds of shows want people to have a definitive answer, and I think Matt Weiner falls into that group.
I scoffed because I thought so too. And then he gave an interview, which we're going to talk about here in a bit.
Oh, he did?
That it was this thing, the one and only interview where he kind of made it very definitive, his view of it.
Which, all right, cool. I'm interested to hear that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I think about that. Doug also has another note. He says, as a side note, the Hilltop ad was filmed in Rome, Italy. Perhaps since Betty speaks Italian and she probably died around the time the commercial was actually being filmed, perhaps there's an implication that Don made this a subtle tribute to her. Think about that. This is for you, Birdie.
I mean, I don't know. I think it's reaching, but that's cool. That's cool.
Catherine S. says, unlike you and a lot of other people, apparently, Betty has been my favorite character since season one, episode two.
Oh, my God. Really?
People are quick to point to incidences and declare that she's a horrible mother. Mm-hmm. But I believe these people forget that we're looking at just slices of her life. Betty has made mistakes with her kids, just like most of our own mothers. It's interesting to me to see all the scenes that people overlook. In the beginning, Betty was a typically stern but loving 60s parent. She regularly referred to Sally as sweetheart, hugged the kids, and related to Sally in the ways that she knew how, showing her about makeup, talking to her about boys, and even telling her, "You're very important to me too," when Sally's having a hard time with baby Jean's arrival. Is Betty a saint? No, but her intentions were never to ruin the lives of her children. As Betty's life became more hectic and she became disillusioned with their life and marriage, their relationship with the children suffered. She told Helen Bishop that without Don, she felt like she was floating away. I believe season 4 was a very difficult emotional time for Betty, and we see her react with a quick trigger temper. But she did come around. Just like Don, I believe Betty has a difficult time believing she was loved. She asks Henry, "Why don't the children love me?" She's noticeably shocked when Sally runs to her and hugs her after she, quote-unquote, becomes a woman. And Betty returns the display of affection by lying down to Sally and being very kind and open with her. People like to pick out the gumdrop incident as a conclusive proof that Betty is terrible. And yes, Betty did mishandle that. But how many men in Betty's life have scarfed down their meals without a second thought to her? In season 1, Don invites Roger for dinner against Betty's wishes, and she has to eat lettuce because there's only enough steak for two. I think it hits her hard when, after she has gone out of her way to her comfort zone on a field trip for Bobby, he still doesn't consider her, trading away her lunch without a second's thought. So she concludes by saying, the viewers see that there's more to it than that, but I believe her perspective is emotionally limited rather than villainous. Do you think, Jim, that we have been too hard on Betty these low many years?
I mean, I can only go by what I remember, and what I remember is a horrible, horrible person. Pretty recently.
It's interesting that going back and watching like season 1 and season 2 Breaking Bad, it changed my perspective on Skyler.
Yeah.
And I would say that Betty certainly was more fully redeemed by the end of this series. I'm very curious. It's one of my things I'm really looking forward to, is to go back and actually see, you know, in Skylar's case, I actually chalk it up to, like, I think the Villigan wanted us to hate her, and things were written, filmed from that perspective, making it very hard to sympathize with her. It could be the same thing with Betty, but I'm curious to see, you know, I'm going to be watching for eyes, like, is January Jones good, and is Betty Draper a good character?
Yeah, I mean, there's potentially selection bias. You know, I hear about, oh, how these horrible things that Betty does, and I get an image in my mind of horrible Betty, and that's all I'm looking for.
And also, this is Don's story, so we only going to get to see the things that are good and bad that impacted Don, and at the late stage of their life that they're at now is mostly bad things, because Don is being a bad father and a bad husband. So you always got that to hang your hat on if you're a Betty supporter, that Don is arguably worse.
That Betty does a lot of good things, we just don't see them.
That, and that also that Don,
that's a stretch, but...
And we've talked about, you know, active neglect, or passive neglect versus active malice, which is worse.
Sure.
Yeah, but anyway, moving on to Philip R. I actually enjoyed the... so this is the thing. This is kind of like, I'm an impersonal indulgence, which I hope you'll allow, Jim. I asked a question about where did the baby Jean Warlock thing come from the Mad Men recap podcast we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. He says, I actually joined the happy hour after the Mad Men recap went defunct. I enjoyed the banter between Dr. John, quote unquote, Ham, and Paul, quote unquote, Giamatti, live from the Brooklyn studios, but I must say you guys do a great job too. The baby Warlock Eugene reference comes from a memorable season 3 episode, Guy Walks Into an Advertising Agency, which our boy Tom worked on, and also saw a man get his foot cut off with a lawnmower. Mm-hmm. In this episode, Sally has trouble sleeping and is distant from baby Jean. This is, of course, upsets the Betty monster, but Don tries to be more comforting. Betty eventually tries to comfort Sally by giving her a Barbie doll from Eugene. Betty insists that the gift is really from Eugene, but Sally notes that the baby could not have written the card. To this, Betty replies, well, we know that babies have fairies that can do things for them. Don then comes home later that night and finds the Barbie in a bush by the front door. He collects the doll and puts it back on the shelf facing Sally's bed. Upon seeing it, she starts screaming hysterically. Don calms her, but she starts up again when Betty brings the awoken Eugene into the room. Don learns that Sally thinks that because Eugene has the same name as a recently deceased grandfather, she is actually a ghost. Don and Betty then get into a fight about the name. So a long story short, Ghost Baby Eugene with his entourage of fairy minions is the origin of the baby warlock meme. Understandably, this beast story in the episode is just a bit overshadowed by the guy from London getting his foot cut off by the John Deere riding lawnmower. Yes. And I thank you for clearing that up, because I had a lot of people write in. We have a lot of Mad Men recap fans that have joined us either after or maybe they listened to it. And also I have some news on that. I reached out to Dr. John and asked him if he'd be interested in participating in our post-Mad Men coverage. And we haven't come up with anything definitive yet, but he said that, yes, they're very interested. So cool. If you are a Mad Men recap fan, you might be able to get to hear Dr. John and Paul right here in this podcast talking Mad Men with us.
Sweet.
I would love to see that, as a huge fan. So thanks for clearing that up for me.
I still am not clear on the warlock reference. Warlocks? I don't know anything about warlocks.
Well, warlocks are male witches. There you go.
That's it?
Yeah, that's all you need. So I think that
the
subtext is Betty, Sally threw this Barbie away outside of the room, and then it comes back inexplicably.
Yeah, yeah, I get that.
And he's got this army of fairy helpers, and he's a resurrected warlock of her grandpa Jean. I think it's all...
So it's just a general hint of magic.
Yes. There. And if you want to know the exact origins...
And the baby Jean is responsible for the doll, and therefore he's the witch.
Sure. Go look up the Mad Men podcast episode for A Man Walks Into an Advertising Agency, and I bet they lay it all out.
Probably so.
But it's super funny. It's the most random of the references, and I'd start listening to them in season 4. So I started working my way back to try to figure out, when's the first fucking time they did the baby warlock, and I couldn't do it, so... Hmm. Lisa LL, as I like to call her, Trip L, our senior black correspondent. As I devoured every Mad Men related thing I could after the finale, I came across some things I didn't know. I think you all know of Pete Campbell as a rapist because you call him Rapey Pete, but did you know that both Vincent Kartheiser and Matthew Weiner claim that Pete is not a rapist? Kartheiser says the script called for the au pair in the souvenir episode to kiss Pete back, but the actress didn't want to kiss Kartheiser, and the scene read as way more of a rape than was intended.
Wow, okay. All right, maybe that's why we think the way we do.
Why the Wiener let this happen is a little mind-boggling, because it gave Pete haters a valid reason to dislike the character and be disgruntled with Campbell's happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about this a little bit, because I am not a big fan of these meta-narratives. Like, I don't give a shit what... someone that made the directed Game of Thrones episode wants me to believe about a sex scene with Jaime and Cersei.
Sure.
I don't really care what Vincent Kartheiser and Matt Weiner says is supposed to happen in a scene. Mm. All I can judge is what actually happens in the scene.
What made it onto film.
And if this is true, then it's the odd case of bad job Matthew Weiner, because what made it to the screen is a hell of a lot darker and not consensual based on what he wanted to happen. Now, it could be that Vincent was just taking a lot of heat in the media, and he's already, I imagine playing it. I think his name's Jack Gleason. No, it's not Jack Gleason. Jesus Christ, that's the guy from The Honeymooners.
No, I think it is.
Is it?
I think that's his actual name, yeah.
All right, the kid that plays Joffrey has said it's very, very tough to play a character that everyone hates. Because even when people are saying well-meaning things to you, it's always about you're just a shit. You're a bastard. I hope you die. Thing.
Like, you're Aaron Paul and people are yelling, yo, bitch, at you across the street. That's tolerable,
Yes.
People are coming up to you and saying, I hate your guts.
Yeah.
All day, every day. Like, that's
a gun.
Rough,
and
man.
A gun. You wear mom jeans and you're dumb and you should get... That can wear on you. And clearly it did, because she wrote a whole op-ed about why do people hate Skylar White.
Uh-huh.
It could be, because I remember the first time I heard Vincent Kartheiser speak, he was giving an interview with Terry Gross and talking about how he was kind of the villain for season 1 of Mad Men. So this is like from the very get-go. Mm-hmm. Maybe he just said that. Like, I'm with Trappell here. It boggles my mind that... Yeah. That would be something that just allowed to happen, or the actress calls an audible because she doesn't want to kiss Vincent Kartheiser, who is a dreamboat when he's not in his Pete persona.
Sure, when he's not got the comb over. So they can say what they want, right? But ultimately, what's on screen?
Yes.
And I agree. If they wanted to say that, they should have said it with the visuals of the show.
Let your lips do the talking. If you want to try to have some kind of fig leaf of consent in this scene. She also wants to talk about race. For the most part, I respected the fact that race was not a part of the story that Matt Weiner wanted to tell. In hindsight, Weiner's reluctance to integrate Mad Men into a fully developed African-American character seems like the show's greatest misstep when you consider the fact that African-American Billy Davis was part of the team credited with writing the very Coke ad used to symbolize Don Draper's greatest triumph, which I didn't know before, but I actually read the article about this. And yeah, he was a big part of the whole creation of that. She concludes black people were definitely a part of the same world Don was in. I mean, it does feel like that is a valid criticism that Mad Men didn't do as much about race. And even when you're talking sexual identity, they just really scratched the surface of what was all there and available in the 60s and early 70s. But it's also hard to say that Mad Men had to be everything to all people. Like, it couldn't be a social commentary about literally everything in America. It couldn't be anti-war and, you know, pro-civil rights and pro-gay rights and anti-pollution. And, like, it's like, you know, pollution's bad. It made a, you know, it kind of make you like, oh, huh, when Betty, you know, fucked up a state park or whatever they're at and Don threw a beer can in a creek.
Yeah.
It's like a passing thing, but it wasn't what the main narrative is about.
It's certainly not a part of the main narrative. I mean, there's nothing in there that's part of the main narrative except for Don's journey, right?
Yeah.
But I felt like they were starting to go that way, and then they just kind of backed off.
So that's what...
Like, with Shirley and Don, I thought they were headed in that direction.
You and Lisa LL are on the exact same wavelength, because she continues that Weiner has said the characters of Betty and Joan were much smaller parts until she saw January Jones and Christina Hendricks and realized the character's full possibilities. Hmm. I wish the Weiner had found the black actor who made him curious enough to explore race as he did feminism. I think the actress who played Shirley sparked something in the storytelling, but it was too late in the series to develop it. I agree with that. I thought Shirley was by far the most interesting person. Like, I like Dawn, but Dawn always felt like kind of just another secretary.
Yeah, she didn't feel like she had any real ambition or drive, whereas Shirley had like a fire to her.
And Dawn didn't pop until we met Shirley. Now, it could be that you just need to have more than one person from a particular voice to bounce where, you know.
Like a support network of
sorts. You have to give a context, because if she just goes into Don's office, Dawn does, and says, let me tell you about the struggles of being a black woman in the 60s, Dawn, he'd be like, get the fuck out of my office or go get me coffee. Whereas if you can see those two kind of like, if there was not a Joan character, any other person in the secretary pool, what would we think about Peggy?
Sure.
Peggy is kind of defined
her character too,
about her conflict and camaraderie with Joan as much as she is about her relationship with Don.
Yeah.
So they were kind of fighting that battle with one hand tied behind their backs for most of the series.
Yeah. And it might just be a case of, oh, we got into this too late.
Yeah. And it's a missed opportunity, yes, but also it's fair to say it wasn't in his mission statement either.
That's probably true, yeah.
But thank you for all your contributions you've made over the years. James V said, just in case you've seen this or haven't seen this, Matthew Weiner has spoken. As far as who created the ad, Don or Peggy, Matthew Weiner says it was all Don, and then he elaborates in this interview that he gave the day after the finale. He said,
let's hear it.
The idea that some enlightened state and not just a co-option might have created something that is very pure was an attractive way to end the series, Matthew Weiner said. To me, it's the best ad ever made, and it comes from a very good place. So not only did he definitively state that Don wrote the ad, but he says it is an enlightened state and something that's very pure. Now, that's not as open and shut as in saying Don is fine, Don, but... Yeah. It's kind of more than I wanted to hear.
I guess. I mean, I knew that hug with Refrigerator Man was honest and pure. It's just a matter of what you think Don's going to do afterward.
If David Chase can pull the shit he did on Sopranos and then drop the mic and never pick it up again.
Yeah, you want him to do the same.
Yeah, because I feel like this is already less ambiguous but just as interesting of an ending. I don't think it needed the post. I'm kind of with Bill Simmons on that. He says Bill has been talking a lot about how he's hating these victory laps that creators are making after shows off the air. Or even when a season concludes, it's like, or if there's an especially, dramatic episode or a controversial episode. He's like, just go away. You made the thing. Let us have our reactions to it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm mostly on board with that. I think there are some things that creators should probably clear up if people fundamentally misunderstand them.
Yeah.
But I don't want the creator necessarily to tell me what conclusion to draw from it.
Hey, the things I like to hear from a creator, what are his influences? What is in his heart and mind when he's making this stuff? The actual process, some alternatives that they considered. Like, I love hearing that. Like, well, we thought about the writer's room, mm-hmm. with the going this way, but we ultimately went this way. And here's what I like hearing some of the whys.
Why they make the choices.
Hearing the what's and the who's and the where's, especially when mm-hmm. you make something that's kind of ambiguous and open to interpretation.
Yeah.
Like, if you wanted to do that, have a scene of Don going back to McCann Erickson and, you know, make it up. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Not a big fan.
That's fair.
Josh P. has a few quick observations. First of all, the scene where Joan says at least someone's timing was right to Roger feels like it could have come after Richard had said goodbye to her, but it didn't. Could this have been a mix-up with the editing? Shots fired.
Mix up with editing.
Shots fired at the editor of this episode.
Like, whoops, we stuck this in the wrong place. Or, like, they just didn't consider it at the time. Because I seriously doubt they just accidentally placed it where they placed it.
I think it was, I mean, just go without saying, and despite what Vincent Kartheiser says about Rapey Pete, it should go without saying that I don't think anything gets to our television without Matthew Weiner really thinking about it, right? Mm-hmm. So, if you do put it after the breakup with Richard, this makes the scene more about Joan and Richard than it does Joan and Roger. The way it came before all that, it makes it seem like, you know, two mature people saying we could have had something, but the timing wasn't there and I'm not bitter about it and I'm happy for you and you're happy for me. Putting it after the Richard breakup changes that chemistry of that scene, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it definitely would. It sounds to me like you think it gives Roger a little bit happier of an ending with the placement it has.
I don't know. It makes Joan feel like she sounds more regretful about Roger going with it post-breakup than it does before.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it gives Roger a happier ending or not, but
it also they come to some kind of terms there.
Yeah.
In that scene. And if you're saying, well, what's going through Joan's head is all about Richard, not about Roger, then it can't really, you can't have that moment between that pure moment between Roger and Joan.
Yeah, I agree. Because again,
so it takes something away from Roger's side of the equation too.
Yeah. It's harder for me to put my finger on that part, piece of the aspect.
Well, but it felt like that's what that scene was for, right? Not to say necessarily anything about Joan, other than like, yeah, they had this relationship. It didn't go where they wanted it to. Mm-hmm. But that scene is more, in my opinion, for Roger, because mm-hmm. it's the last time we see him. You know, that's Roger's swan song. He's going out, leaving his stuff to his kid. And I think it diminishes it if Joan is thinking about another person at that point.
Yeah.
And we as an audience know
and
that.
I don't want to feel like Joan's pining after Richard or feel like he's the one that got away. And that's,
yeah,
that's if I really true. Zero in on it, uh-huh. changing it post Richard makes that line real more rueful than
you're
wise.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, that's the comment on that. He says, secondly, I love the visual of Don, a man who always runs away when he feels confused, trapped, or scared, being at a location where he's literally at the edge of a cliff on the other side of the country that he just drove across, and now he can't physically run anymore.
He could swim. We've seen him swim.
That's true. He could go north, head up to Seattle or Alaska.
But yeah, I like that too. That's interesting.
Yeah, he's like a lemming that just didn't have the courage of conviction to jump. Finally, and I may be reading way too much in this. Why not? That's what we do here on the Happy Hour. Mm-hmm. But I feel that everyone's story in the end represents a part of Don's soul or a point of his life where he faced the same decision in a relationship, but this time things end up for the best.
Oh,
for example, Pete chooses to reconcile with his wife and regain the life that Don once told him he was missing, as Don had done with Betty. Roger choosing to be with Marie represents Don choosing not to be Dr. Fay and instead marrying the much younger woman. Dr. Fay was a fellow professional who in many ways was on his level, and he didn't want the hang up of a family and kids. Sally, who's faced with a horrible situation, chooses to step up and deal with it responsibly instead of running away as Don would have done. I like that a lot. These are essentially alternate alternate paths that Don could have taken in his life. Which makes me
think... So does that say anything about how happy these people are going to be?
Yeah, if I look it through that lens, then I want to say that everyone mentioned is okay. That was my lens I was holding up, by the way.
Okay. Yeah, I could see that. It's an interesting idea. I like it.
All right. Mildly interesting, even. Hey, this is going to be the last time I get to tell a lot of you about how you can support Bald Move. Well, hopefully, if you're sticking around Bald Move, it won't be the last opportunity, but... something Jim just worked on recently. We can now accept credit card payments, not just PayPal, for Club Bald Move. So if you've been waiting on that, you've been leery about the grimy little pimp that is PayPal, the grimy little PayPal. Go ahead and use our cart with confidence now that we got Stripe and SSL security and all that good stuff. It's a great deal. For as low as $1 a month, you get video releases of all our podcasts, which in many cases can get you to podcast hours in advance of its release. You can get the Lunch with Jim and Aaron, where it's a weekly session where you can interact with us and hang out in our studio with us. You get ad-free podcast feeds, so you never have to listen to me pitch another product or pitch another way to support us again. You can just like set on autopilot, forget it. VIP access into forums, a lot of cool stuff. If that seems
that's just what you get right now, there's a lot more coming.
There's a lot more coming. If that seems like too much of a commitment, Roger... then you can also support us by buying us nice, cool gifts by going to amazon.baldmove.com. And actually, you're buying gifts for you.
Yes.
That we're getting our beak wet because we got the amazon.baldmove.com. The bald move in the middle of the dots does all the business. Mm-hmm. Because what it does is it redirects you to Amazon. And instead of Jeff Bezos getting to keep all that money, like he needs it, like he really needs it. We get a tiny fraction of his profits.
Yeah, you wouldn't give money to Roger, would you?
No.
What is he going to do with your money?
No, if you could take 5 cents out of every paycheck that Roger gets from McCann Erickson and send it to Bald Move, wouldn't you?
Of course.
Wouldn't you?
Of course.
Roger would do it. Mm-hmm. He might have to get coked up or LSD to do it, but he would do it. Mm-hmm. Amazon.baldmove.com lets you make Jeff Bezos your personal Roger Sterling.
That's exactly
what we're saying here, and it also sends us love and it keeps us going, and that's what we're looking to do. We want to keep banging out these podcasts for your enjoyment, and help us cobble these shoes together. We appreciate it. Lewis R. said, when you guys talked about the cactus and how their baby would be approximately 5 years old, either I heard it wrong or you guys added wrong. That baby is born early on in either 1960 or 61, if memory serves, making the boy at least 10 years old. Yeah, I fucked that up. Peggy had her kid at the end of season one. That was 10 years ago in Showtime. I don't know what the hell I was thinking. I was all caught up in the whole cactus womb analogy. Yeah. And I just went with it, man. I just went with it.
All right. You know, you make mistakes when you speak on something for hours at a time.
You know,
off the cuff.
Or even 5 minutes. We've debated a lot about, are there teenagers watching Mad Men, you know?
I seriously doubt it.
Well, Jesse K, an 18-year-old, would like to disagree
what?
With you.
Why are you watching Mad Men? Does he or she say? I don't know. Jesse is not a...
It's spelled with a masculine
okay.
Spelling.
All right, well.
So
tell me why. Tell me why you watch Mad Men.
In his own words, the show as a whole has had a massive effect on me. I've always enjoyed film and media. But it was Mad Men that first introduced me to the complexity and art of television and film and how powerful of an impact it can have. It's truly an example of how sometimes it's more about the journey than the destination. It's inspired me to take filmmaking classes in high school and to pursue a career in critiquing and or teaching about film. It is and probably will always be my favorite television show. I gotta say, Jesse, you seem like a kind of dude that I would have loved to hang out with in high school.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm kind of jealous of you because I think this is going to be something so cool when you're in your mid-20s and when you're in your early 30s and your late 30s. This is something you can visit again and again and again and get something new from. Whereas I've just got to go through the lens of my you know, early onset senility memory that, like, you know, what it felt like to be a teenager and go through some of these experiences and what it felt like to be a child. That's cool. Cause I think this is a series that definitely can grow with you.
I think so. Yeah. I just felt like watching it, it started at a later age.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, maybe
it can grow.
Maybe
with
you've
you,
been watching this in real time. Started like 11. He started with the, when he's 11 and, oh, yeah. and watched that.
Who was letting you watch this when you're 11?
Man, the books that my mother and father let me read because they just assumed I was reading books and how much, but I honestly, my mom should have not cared so much about the Doom and cared a lot more about some of the other shit I was reading, some of the really subversive, fucked up shit. Uh-huh. And it's made me the interesting person I am today. So rock on, Jesse. He continues. He wants to talk about his favorite episodes. These include The Suitcase, The Better Half, Lost Horizon, Tomorrowland, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, The Phantom, The Crash, Shut the Door, Have a Seat, Far Away Places, The Strategy, The Wheel, The Monolith, and Waterloo. These include scenes that will stay with me forever.
Yeah.
The Wheel was the pitch that hooked me. Waterloo taught me that the best things in life are free. The Strategy showed the reconnection of two friends as one of my favorite songs played. Faraway Places gave us Roger tripping balls. The Great Heist that pulled the rug out from under the Brits made me giggle and cheer. Ken tap dancing as everyone ran around on amphetamine was perfection. The Phantom showed us that Don's life is truly cyclical. And The Suitcase, my personal favorite, showed Don fully open up to Peggy, something entirely new to him.
Yeah, that's a strong list there.
Strong resume.
Yeah, a couple of them that I really liked that weren't on that list. I like commissions and fees a lot. It's Lane's death.
Shocking.
It was shocking.
Because I remember covering that, and a lot of people were talking about the death. Nobody called Lane Price.
No, and the way it came about, you know, with him just writing this check that he got found out and Don fires him and Don's trying to talk him through it. Like, this is the hardest moment. It will all get easier.
Yep.
I mean, I really like Lane Price as a character, and seeing him go out was rough for me. And it was also an exciting episode.
Yeah.
So that's a good one. Another one that I really like that I think is overlooked a lot is at the Codfish Ball. It's the first time that Roger and Marie hook up, gives him the old blow jay in the back room there during the award show.
Yeah.
I really like that one. It had a lot to do with Sally coming on this awards trip with him, and you know, she's scarred by it at the end, similarly to how she's scarred in season 6 with Sylvia.
She had so many adult situations.
Yeah.
If only she could see the content warnings that come on before Mad Men, she would know. Oh shit, adult content. I'm just going to skip this episode. You know, one thing we talk about that the Lane Price moment. The one thing I really miss now that we're doing all this instant cast stuff, which is, you know, obviously really successful for us in terms of traffic and making fans happy on some of these other shows, I used to be able to watch in real time people on Facebook and forums and stuff. And I miss going into the commercial breaks and doing that.
Yep.
I mean, like I said, I wouldn't go back because, again, you look at the traffic numbers, our Game of Thrones instant cast, but I do miss it. I do miss it. It sucks.
Yeah. You know, you have to make sacrifices.
Things you got to do for your career. Bill from Houston said, rate the missed opportunity on a character by character status update basis. These are characters that didn't get a mention about their future.
Hmm.
These are the ones we didn't say okay or not okay. Sal.
Man, when's the last time we saw Sal?
The last time we saw Sal, he was checking in with his wife from a payphone in Central Park and about to go and get some rando in a bush. Things were heading to dark places for him. He'd just been fired.
Yeah.
Because he was sexually harassed. It's incredible. And the fact that we never saw him again is still kind of shocking to me.
It is.
I really thought that something with Bob Benson or something his final season, something.
Man, I think probably not okay.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's like for a gay person during that period, but it can't be good.
Not good, Jim. Not good.
You're right. Pete knows exactly how it is. I'm going to say not okay for him.
Teddy Chagagagagaga.
Yeah. Teddy's fine.
Yeah. He's a sheep.
Teddy's happy. You know,
he's in the pasture.
Yeah.
He's just going to check his brain off. He's going to let someone else drive.
He's going to fly around the country doing whatever he does.
He's going to reunite with 5 years
from now, he's going to cash out and be...
with his college sweetheart, right?
Right as rain.
And fly around the world and get in all kinds of adventures. Dawn.
She just mysteriously disappeared this season.
Dawn is such... and she's such a kind of a sketch of a character. Like, she was there to be awkwardly hugged during the assassination of Martin Luther King and to have Peggy be... waspy racist to her in her apartment, but she was strong, resourceful, intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like she'll be fine, but I feel like I have a better handle on the Shirley character than I do Dawn.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't feel like we got any real ending for her.
Yeah, so. That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Freddie Rumson. Does he stay clean and sober? Is he gone to piss in his pants?
He's going to keep drinking. He's going to keep pissing.
No, he stopped all that.
No.
He stopped all that. He got cleaned up.
He stopped that.
Don was ghostwriting for him.
Don stopped abusing women. Come on.
No, I think Freddie'd be okay. Bob Benson.
Man, Bob Benson. He got turned down hard. Went to GM. I feel like he's not going to be happy there.
Well, so I figure, man, is Detroit a better or worse city to be a gay man in the 60s?
The New York, probably worse.
Does he decide that he goes, is he continue to go beard hunting? Is he trying to find his Joan? Or the bachelor kind of like millionaire playboy, Bruce Wayne / Liberace, ladies man on the surface, but he's...
He probably got a raise after that incident with what's his name?
And money
where
can,
he was in
money,
jail.
If nothing else, can afford you a lot of discretion.
That's true.
And if you're living an unconventional lifestyle in a society that judges you, discretion counts for a lot. Discretion can buy you a lot of armor for you to live your life the way you want to live it and keep it under wraps.
Unless Pete which Campbell seems like spots a miser- you at a whorehouse.
Which seems like a miserable way to live. I mean, that was kind of me through my mid-20s. Yeah, I was a Jehovah's Witness, but I really wanted to watch rated R movies and... see what the world is about. Like, I don't want to...
You don't have to be sneaking around to do the stuff you want to do.
Hell no.
That's a horrible existence.
That fucking shit is corrosive to your soul, man. Yeah. Wearing a mask to everyone in your life? Fuck.
Ridiculous.
Not knowing who's safe to drop that mask to?
Yeah, so I feel like Bob's not that well off either.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's at the very least going to have to hide who he is. He didn't seem like he...
On the other
had
hand,
some kind of revelation that made him say, fuck it, I'm gay and I don't care.
That other auto, maybe him and the other auto exec can bond and like keep watching each other's back.
Eh, maybe. What do you mean by bond?
I mean, not like in a, I mean, just like, you know, have something that they can relate to and watch each other's back. Just like I said.
That exec did not seem to want to talk about it.
Well, of course not. Because of all the punching and the judgment and the it was illegal at the time. I mean,
sure. I don't know that he's going to open up to Bob is what I'm saying.
You know, I don't know.
Maybe give it time.
Any others were, I mean, there's so many people like Paul Kinsey.
I mean, yeah. Duck.
Not okay.
Lou Avery.
Not okay.
Never okay.
Kinsey, not okay.
Yeah, no.
I never saw a Star Trek script, and I've seen like every Star Trek known to man. Not okay.
No.
All right, moving on. Matthew C. I just want to tell you there's nothing bad about a cactus as a gift. When Pete gave it to Peggy, all I felt was warmth. Here's a quote from the book, The Power of One, to prove my point. And you know, I bet Matthew W. has read it and he remembers it.
Probably.
The quote is, God has no quarrels, madam. The Almighty conceived a cactus plant. If God would choose a plant to represent him, I think he would choose, of all plants, a cactus. The cactus has all the blessings he tried and mostly failed to give to man. Let me tell you how. It is a humility, but is not submissive. It grows where no other plant will grow. It does not complain when the sun bakes it back, or the wind tears it from the cliff, or drowns it in the dry sand of the desert, or when it's thirsty. When the rains come, it stores water for the long, hard times to come. In good times and in bad, it still flowers. It protects itself against danger, but harms no other plant. It adapts perfectly to almost any environment. It has patience and enjoys solitude. The cactus has properties that heals the wounds of men, and from it comes potions that can make man touch the face of God or stare into the very mouth of hell. It is the plant of patience and solitude, love and madness, ugliness and beauty, toughness and gentleness. Of all plants, surely God has made the cactus to his own liking. It has my enduring respect and is my passion. Huh. This is the gift that Pete just carelessly gave away to Peggy.
All right.
What an asshole.
I mean, he's arguing it's a nice gift. Why is he an asshole?
It's God's own cactus. It's God's own plant. That's the best you can say. It's a gift. It's a good gift. I know what you're getting for Christmas now,
well,
buddy.
If God is to be believed, then humans have squandered better gifts than a cactus. Right?
Debatable.
I don't know, that everlasting life stuff.
Mm.
That seemed pretty good.
Yeah, but we didn't have pants.
Who says pants are good?
The sweat rolling down my ass cheeks in the summer. Maybe if I wasn't wearing pants, I wouldn't have that.
Exactly.
I think that would still, knowing me, it would still be sweaty. Just other people would see the.
Well, we really kind of need. Maybe to move we started on. Sweating this... because of sin. I don't know, but that's what I imagine.
Sure, it started stinking too.
Yeah.
Michael C. from my wife Denise, who usually writes in before, but for some reason did not. You got her back, Michael. That's important. She's the only person I've seen who seemed to notice that in the last scene with Joan. She's not. Whoa. She is wearing pants. She did learn from Eve.
She's got a suit instead of a dress.
We cannot remember ever seeing Joan in pants before. In the pilot, Joan was telling Peggy to dress more sexy and show her ankles to be successful at the firm. Mm-hmm. Now Joan has learned and accepted that she does not need a man to make her whole. She, quote unquote, wears the pants and have taken charge of her own future. To me, it seemed like a good representation of feminism. Joan was in a position where she could choose what she wanted. She wasn't forced into anything by her husband or societal pressures. That doesn't mean that she gets everything she wants, i.e. Richard, but the decision was hers to make.
I like that.
I do too.
A subtle but profound change in the character.
Way to go, Denise.
Now, it could just be that she's at home and she can wear pants at home, but I mean, she's working out of her kitchen
or
dining room.
Pants more comfortable?
I don't know. I don't wear dresses, so I couldn't tell you, but I imagine no. I imagine the freeing nature of the dress, although she wears tight dresses.
Millions of Scotsmen can't be wrong.
You're right.
There's got to be something to it. He also says, hands down, my favorite character is Pete. Even though I've seen it way too many times, I still laugh out loud when he enters the elevator. Bob Benson asks how he is, and Pete yells, not great, Bob. Also, his compliment to Peggy was my favorite moment in the show. That's the one in the last episode where he says people are going to brag about working with you.
Yeah, one day. Right after the cactus.
Yep. Right after he shrugs the gift from God that is the cactus.
Pete's got so many great moments.
Pete is a fantastic character. I feel like I have to argue this all the fucking time, but I love Pete as a character. I hate Pete as a human being. And
that's fair, and
you know what? I hope he cleans up his act and finds happiness, because goddamn, Trudy deserves it. She is all that is woman. Should we move on? Yes, we should. Jasmine G says, I'm surprised at your predictions for what would happen to Peggy and Joan. You both seem worried about how Peggy would fare at McCann and hopeful for Joan's future. My reaction was the exact opposite. Peggy's shown us that she can accomplish against great adversity in her career several times over in 7 seasons. The latest episode is no exception. When she realized she had lost an account, she immediately rectified the situation. She hasn't let McCann get to her yet, and judging by her attitude walking to the place and the way she handled that meeting, I don't think it will get her in the future. Plus, she has Stan by her side. Stan's right about this one. Peggy will be successful at whatever she decides to do. Joan, on the other hand, a little worried about Joan. Yes, she started her own company, and it's all very exciting, but Joan has often crumbled in the face of her overt sexism that she faces. Even her triumphant moment at McCann was a half crumble. I don't imagine her new business will bring her any shortage of sexism, and she hasn't shown to have much business acumen either. I'm not sure I agree with that one point. She's been the office manager, and she's deftly handled clients and accounts before. So, I don't know at that point.
Yeah, I mean, but the other stuff.
The other stuff
I do mostly agree with.
All right. Also, going to Peggy for a partnership just reeks of bad instinct. It sounds exciting, but those two are hardly ever on the best of terms. They have conflicting personalities, and Joan should know that. Just look at who she's actually going into business with. Joan has no experience writing, and it appears that her teenage babysitter is her only employee. It also appears that she will be in close proximity to her mother from now on, which doesn't really bode well either. I'm sure that they love each other, but Joan and her mother have never been best buds. In short, Joan's going into a business she doesn't know at all, with little or no staff and poor business instincts. Also entirely possible she ends up doing more coke. Things aren't looking up for Joanie. That's bleak. Does it shift you to the not okay category for Joan?
No, because I don't know that... I mean, does she need to be super successful in order to be happy with what she's doing? Like, yeah, maybe she doesn't get a bunch of movies made. Maybe her company doesn't really go anywhere, but is that going to make her unhappy?
She does have $500,000, too.
Yeah.
So unless she plows every bit of that into a failing business, she's going to be okay. Maybe, I mean, I don't know. Like, what's the worst case scenario here? She spends 2 years trying to get this off the ground. It never really goes off the ground. And she looks up Richard on the backside. Says, you know what? I'm ready to retire to the beach.
Yeah.
By the time my great adventure.
He's found someone else.
If I was Richard.
She's destitute.
If I was Richard.
Oh, no.
My criteria for long-term relationship with another woman is Joan Harris knocks on my door and I tell her, get the fuck out. Beat it. I'm with a better woman than you. Mm-hmm. How many percentage points of women in this world fit that category for you, Jim Jones?
It's in low single digits.
Now, is Richard that smart of a guy? I don't know. Hmm. But one would hope. Anyway.
Yeah, but I think her points on Peggy are...
Joan?
Are right on.
Or Peggy?
No, Peggy.
Okay, yes, agreed.
She has definitely overcome a lot of adversity.
Sure.
And she shows no signs of stopping, so...
Yep.
Yeah, Peggy's going to be okay.
Christopher J., who has a blog with his wife called KitchenWithAView.com, and he wrote an article on that called The Legacy of Mad Men, which is an interesting read. You should check it out. But he says, he's talking about favorite episodes. He says, my favorite episode is, of course, The Suitcase. But something that's rarely talked about and related to that episode is a connection between the great boxer Ali and Don Draper. I talked about the connection on my blog post, but here's a snippet of that. Being a fan of Muhammad Ali, I appreciate the parallels between the young boxer and Don Draper. Despite Don not being a fan of Ali, as he says about him, he's got a big mouth. I'm the greatest. Not if you have to say it. There are similarities between the two. Don reinvented himself by obviously changing his name, such as the boxer did. Doing away with his birth name, Cassius Clay, then renaming himself as Muhammad Ali. Both have a way with words which could captivate any room with their own brands of charm, and they are both infamous womanizers. Yet, Ali was the unappealing new face of a popular culture for Don's generation. Even still, defiance is part of Don Draper too, who we've seen over and over again doing what is best for himself while upsetting others around him in agency. What's great about the historic moments of the show, whether it be the Kennedy assassination, the moon landing, or in this case of Ali versus Liston, the Wiener always manages to find parallels between his fictional characters and historical figures of the time. I thought that was a good write-up.
Yeah.
Good analysis of the Ali versus Don angle there. Moving on, Jonathan W. ponders, is Mad Men the greatest show of our time? Well, it's the only thing on TV which can show you a hot poolside babe, have you squint at your screen, not to admire her body, but to try to catch the title of the book she's reading. I've never hit freeze frame to see what brand of beer McNulty was drinking or what type of detergent the whites were using at the car wash. This is all true.
The only other show that's better at that is Lost, but...
Not as rewarding.
Yeah, I can buy that.
Like, I still don't know. I remember the feeling I got when I read a blog, because I was a big fan of Lost in the first two seasons, when I saw the blog post that said, the shark has a Dharma logo initiative on its tail. And I'm like,
yeah.
Fuck yeah, it does. Fuck yeah, that shark has got a logo on it.
I mean, even just
but
the hatch.
Did it matter? Like, yeah.
Nah, sure.
That's the thing.
That show did not conclude as elegantly as Mad Men did.
Now, you can say, does any of this shit matter? Did Dante's Inferno matter? Because I know, like, Dante's Inferno launched a million theories about what that meant, and most of them didn't come to fruition. But that never seemed to be the point of Mad Men. It's not plot-driven. It's feeling-driven. And these extra, even subconscious details, I think, served those purpose the way that Lost, maybe, it was more just intellectual masturbation. I don't know.
Yeah, what you just said is going to factor into my determination of where this falls in the pantheon of golden age television.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You got a, is that what we're going to say at the end of the podcast?
I guess so.
I almost forgot. We need to make a note of that.
Oh, you don't have a note?
Your job is remember to not to not forget.
Okay.
To not forget that we need to talk about that. Ethan T, did any of you or either of you notice during the series finale that Don racing across the Bonneville Flats felt out of place? I thought it looked awesome, but yeah, the close-up face of him and the helmet and all
that. Yeah, I questioned like how the fuck he got involved in this stuff.
Sure.
You know, it felt very weird.
Well, my first reaction was that Don was doing his best speed racer impersonation. As a 20-year-old who hasn't seen any of the comics nor the live-action movie, this was a strange place for my brain to go.
20-year-olds. What are 20-year-olds? 20-year-olds and 18-year-olds watching this show?
It's they are forward-thinking, emotionally mature individuals who are ready to conquer the world, I would submit.
Apparently so.
But as you'll remember, Lou Avery's departure came with his giggles about how the studio had bought his comic was the same as the one that created Speed Racer. So what could all this mean? My interpretation is that while Lou was good at his job, he's always trying to be something he's not, creating a comic hoping to be as popular as another, filling Don's shoes only to be ousted by him. Lou is the wannabe Scout's Honor, and Don is the real deal Speed Racer. Fuck you, Lou.
I love it. Lou's gonna come back to McCann. He's gonna make an ad for Diet Coke. That's going to go over nowhere nearly as well.
No.
Great, tastes great, less filling is his ad campaign.
No, that's actually a successful one.
But not a successful
here's
ad.
Here's Lou Avery's comeback and his crowning moment of glory.
Uh-huh.
New Coke.
Oh, God. You're right.
He
You're
finally right. gets totally a major Lou. Account. It's New Coke, and it's the worst thing ever.
Yep.
There you go. Adam X said, if or when Lionsgate makes a complete Mad Men series on Blu-ray or whatever format, I think it would be a good idea if they added one commercial where the former commercial breaks that were from... Oh, okay, okay. They added one in which you have commercials in the former commercial breaks on the DVD that are actually from the year that the current episode is portraying. Since it's a big part of the show is about American advertising, I think that would add to the fun, ambience, and nostalgia of the show. Not only should they show commercials that were popular and award-winning at the time, but ones that would be deemed politically incorrect in our day and age. Like my favorite politically incorrect commercial, the Flintstones for Winston cigarettes, which he actually includes a YouTube.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen that one.
That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I love that.
Like, maybe not the full, like, 3-4 commercials, but one commercial in each break, and it's an optional thing that you can select from the menu.
Mm-hmm.
That would be tits.
I agree.
That'd also be a shit ton of work for some poor intern to do.
Yeah, I mean, you got to get rights to all those things, and it's going to be a pain.
That also. Although... it'd probably be easy to get the rights to the ads like the Coke commercial, less so to get something that's personally embarrassing to a brand.
Yeah, I mean, politically incorrect stuff might be tough. I mean, just tracking down the people who own this stuff at this point might be difficult.
Well, if the company, I don't know if the company's, I don't know how the intellectual
like a Lucky
property.
Strike commercial. Is Lucky Strike still around?
Are
they still
smoke.
A company or they get bought out?
I don't know.
Yeah, so that's the kind of stuff, you know, you'd have to go do research.
Exactly.
Before you can even pay.
But it is a fantastic idea, Adam.
It is. I love it.
Joseph V said, I was wondering if the Bald Move Network is interested in starting a Kickstarter for a Mad Men spinoff called King Lear. It will go through the rise, the fall, and the rise again of Peter Dykeman Campbell as the Learjet corporate titan.
I love the name.
I think it's a winner. I welcome all who want to partner up.
All right.
I, too, would love to see like a King Lear... I was joking with a listener through email today about, like, when is Matthew Weiner the whiner? God, I've got my own jokes mixed up. When is Matthew Weiner going to crack and do advertising in the 80s? Like, 10 years from now, he's bored. He's got these accolades. He's done some successful movie projects, another successful television project. John Hamm's 10 years older. Elizabeth...
Moss,
almost said Olsen, is 10 years older. All these people are 10 years older. Betty's dead. Mad Men, the Next Generation.
Wait. January Jones is dead? Is that what you're saying?
No, but Betty
okay,
is.
All right, cool.
Who says no to Mad Men, the Next Generation?
I think if he's smart, Matt Weiner does. Honestly. Like, there's no faster way to get pigeonholed.
I'm just saying, 10 years from now, that's going to look like a really hot idea. And everyone will age beautifully for it.
We'll see. We'll see
you
how it
want
goes.
To see Don looking like Don Johnson?
I mean, I didn't say I don't want to see it.
Okay.
I think it'd be cool.
Roger's probably dead, too. That's kind of a bummer.
Yeah. I don't know if he's got another 10 years in him.
Yeah. Grimy little Mitch.
Also,
writes,
there would be a lot of ads that I would remember, which would be cool.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. I am a child of the 80s. That would be freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Grimy Little Mitch said, I've always been fascinated by how Mad Men's song selections tied so well to the theme of the episodes. I was wondering if you guys had any songs from Mad Men that really stood out to you. I could list a bunch, but the ones that immediately come to mind for me are Both Sides Now by Judy Collins from In Care Of, where Don is showing his kids the house he grew up in. Roy Orbison's Sha Da Broba from Shut the Door and Have a Seat, where Don calls Betty from the hotel where they're starting their agency, and he finally agrees to go along with her plan for the divorce. A couple other gems are Johnny Mathis's What I'll Do from Jet Set, Simon and Garfunkel's Bleecker Street from The Suitcase, and Bob Dylan's Don't Think Twice, It's All Right from the season one finale. I thought Joni Mitchell was the Both Sides Now one. That's the played at the end of 613 In Care Of, which I actually think is fantastic. That's probably my choice. There's something so bittersweet and sing-song and sad about it, and it goes so well with the looks Don and Sally were giving each other. That's my choice. Do you have any
music
selections?
I know there were a bunch, but I just don't remember necessarily how they fit into the episodes. The one that I, the few that I do remember, I mean, obviously there's the recent ones like Buddy Holly is in there, and I love that song. And then they had a Beatles song that was like kind of a watershed moment for the series. Where,
which one,
like,
was that?
Tomorrow Never Knows.
Right.
Like, they, from what I've read, they had to pay a lot of money for that.
Yep, I remember that being controversial.
Because the Beatles don't release their music for that kind of stuff. You know, for Apple commercials, yeah.
Yeah.
For Mad Men, yes. For anything
Steve
else.
Steve Jobs money.
Yeah, apparently.
Matthew Weiner money.
So I definitely remember that one standing out. But that's about it.
All right. Maybe that's something else we can do. We can pick a song of the decade or song of the year for each season of Mad Men, too.
Yeah. Sounds cool.
Well, bittersweet moment again is this is the last of the regular season coverage of Mad Men. We have another episode coming out with Tom Wilson and talking about editing Mad Men. That hopefully you guys will help us out and send that your comments and questions at madmen@baldmove.com. That'll be out in the next week or two. But I would like to encourage you to guys, if you're big Mad Men fans, to keep subscribe to the feed and check out what we've got in June, July, so forth as we do our season by season recap coverage. Not recap, retrospective coverage of that and how it fits in. I'm really excited to do that. I'm really excited to go back and revisit Mad Men. I hope you guys join us on that journey. If not, again, Bald Move keeps...
Nope.
What?
Before we get out of here, man, you're trying to escape without answering this question.
Oh, damn. I almost did it.
Mad Men, where does it fit into the golden age of television and how does it rank?
It's my personal favorite. It goes Mad Men.
Okay, that was spoiled at the very beginning of the cast.
It goes Mad Men, The Wire, Breaking Bad for me.
Wow. Okay. See, I'm still Breaking Bad at the top.
Now, it's hard for me to differentiate between favorite and best.
Sure.
Like, if you ask me what's the best, I kind of want to say The Wire. If you ask me what's the most important, I kind of want to say The Wire. But if you ask me straight up what my favorite show is, it's Mad Men.
Okay, interesting. So best, most important, and favorite.
Yeah.
I give you three different answers.
Okay.
Best, I give you Mad Men.
Okay.
Most important, I give you The Wire. Favorite, I give you Breaking Bad.
It's that very defensible. Like, because Breaking Bad, it sucks.
The entertainment level is just off the charts.
It stings my ass that I have to put it in third place.
Yeah.
But... Breaking Bad was super entertaining and it did blow my mind occasionally, but nothing blew my mind as relentlessly as both Mad Men and The Wire. And kind of changed
different
how,
way.
And changed how I think about a lot of different things in the world too.
Well, I think it's telling that some of my favorite episodes are the ones that are heavily plot driven in Mad Men. Cause that's just the way I am. You know, I like to see a really good plot.
There ain't nothing wrong with being the way you are, Jim.
And
you are going to be
as far
okay.
I'm A-okay. As far as the plot goes, I think Breaking Bad is a superior show to any of those shows. The Wire says more about society than any of the other shows. And Mad Men is just like week after week after week, it was consistently brought the Thunder, you know? It never wavered in how good it was.
I described it in one of her very first podcasts as relentlessly watchable. And that's what I think Mad Men is. Like,
I think it's hard to watch it sometimes.
Really?
But that doesn't make it bad.
I find that the hours always just flew by. Like,
I feel that way about Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. I mean, when we're talking at the tip of the iceberg, you start to get some lines that are blurred between, you know, Mad Men has some visceral thrills.
Yeah.
Breaking Bad had a lot more of them.
Oh, yeah.
The Wire had a lot of them, too. Mm-hmm. You know, Mad Men had mind-blowing moments. I think Mad Men had more, and The Wire had more. Tightly plotted. I mean, it's really, really gets hard when you carve things up. But if I'm talking about my personal favorite, this is Aaron's favorite. It is definitely Mad Men.
Okay.
Now,
that's fair.
You know, I got to get through another rewatch of Mad Men, and I need to do, I still have not yet done a complete high def rewatch of The Wire, but it's going to be hard, because I always said Mad Men was the threat for the number one spot. It's the one after Breaking Bad concluded and The Wire survived. It was the one that I was currently watching had a chance to bump off the King.
Yeah.
You come at the King, you best not miss. And I think Matthew Weiner did enough in these final two seasons to end it in a very just extremely satisfying. I felt so satisfied at the end of this final episode of Mad Men. And I honestly, without any kind of hate or shade thrown, feel very sorry for the people that feel raw about it, because that just sucks, man. That just sucks.
Sure, like, you invest so much time
in the Super Bowl. You got one group of fans is going to be happy and one group that's going to be just devastated. Yeah. I hate that Mad Men feels like a Super Bowl for people because it's nothing but joy for me.
Yeah. No,
nothing but happiness.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. And even though there was a lot of surprising flip-flopping on characters near the end,
yeah,
I didn't feel like any of it was unwarranted.
Yeah.
They earned it with me, and it just brought it all to a satisfying end.
Yep. So I'll say this is it, but it's not. We still got at least 8 more episodes to go, spread out over the next 7 to 8 months. I have no idea if this is going to be a successful project. I don't really give a shit. This is something I want to do personally, and if I get on the mic and record for an hour or two at the end of for each season, then that's just a nice little side effect. So if you'd like to get in on that, again, madmen@baldmove.com. Follow along all of our stuff at baldmove.com and on facebook.com/baldmove and on Twitter. You can also get on our forums and discuss this stuff. And, like, you know, I really love to get a forum discussion, like almost a book club style review of the seasons of Mad Men. I'll probably go start one right now for people to kind of compile and get stuff together. I'm really looking forward to it. It's also another way for me to stave off saying goodbye to Mad Men.
Yeah. I know.
If I'm being brutally honest, that's a lot of this project.
No, I could tell.
Yeah. So there you go.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening to not only this episode, but all of the episodes we've covered Mad Men in. Really appreciate all your support, and we'll be back in the future. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See you, everybody. The top of 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 the top of